It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Anne Strainchamps. Today, writing funny.
Comedy is about being honest. It can be a brutal honesty, but it's some way of telling a truth about people.
That's Bob Odenkirk, comedy writer, performer, actor, and one of our guests today, as we talk about the fine art of writing comedy. Also, Megan Amram reimagines science for girly girls.
I would call this a feminist satirical science textbook, which, you know, there's a lot of them, but I hope mine rises to the top.
And one of the highlights of any issue of The New Yorker, the cartoons. Although The New Yorker has a more highbrow term for them.
And nowhere in the contract does it mention the word cartoon. It calls them idea drawings.
But first, Simon Rich. He's barely 30 years old and already has a reputation as one of America's funniest writers. He was one of the youngest ever sketch writers for Saturday Night Live. He sold film rights to Jason Reitman and worked as a staff writer for Pixar. And he's just released his sixth book, a collection of short stories called Spoiled Brats, which includes a story about a woman who gives birth to a demon and copes by putting him on Ritalin. The stories have to be experienced. So here's Simon with the first one called Animals.
They buried my wife in a shoebox in Central Park. I like to imagine that the funeral was respectful, that her body was treated with a modicum of dignity. But of course I'll never know. I wasn't invited to the ceremony. Instead, the guests of honor were the students of Homeroom 2K, her killers. When the children returned from the burial, they drew tributes to my wife in magic marker, model and scribbles of halos, wings, and harps. It was hard not to vomit as Miss Hudson taped them up above my cage. I've never seen such tasteless dreck in all my life. Haley, I noticed, was crying as she drew. The irony. It was her responsibility to refill our water bottle last week. Instead, she spent all her free time with Alyssa, practicing a clapping game called Miss Mary Mac. Miss Mary Mac, all dressed in black. It was that inane chant that provided the score to my wife's final moments. She was dying of thirst, but never cried once. It was only later that I realized why. Her body was too dehydrated to produce tears. Pocahontas was her name.
Simon, this is such black comedy. I read some of the beginning of it out loud to my husband over dinner the other night, and it took a while before we could eat.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah, I swear that story gets funnier.
Yeah.
It starts out a little harshly.
Where did the idea to write a story from a hamster's point of view come from?
Well, that's a very autobiographical story because I am the villain. Simon Rich is the neglectful 8-year-old who forgets to feed the family of hamsters. So it's very much based on my own childhood experiences.
Really? Did you have hamsters and forget to feed them?
Oh, yeah, constantly. You know, I was so spoiled and lazy, somebody would usually luckily do it for me. So there weren't so many deaths on my hands. But yeah, the story was just me thinking back on what a terrible 8-year-old I was, jacked up on sugar all the time, and just thinking how tragic it was that the life of a family of hamsters was ever put into my hands. So I thought it'd be funny to write about that period of time through the hamster's eyes.
So was this meant as a kind of homage or even apology to previous generations of hamsters?
Multiple generations of hamsters. Yeah, I think you could definitely see it as something of an apology, as a mea culpa.
So you put yourself in this story and you put yourself in another later story, which we'll get to in a minute. But why? Why do you like doing that?
It's a lot of fun. I wanted to write something personal and confessional and honest. I tried writing about these experiences in the first person, but when you're writing about yourself in the first person, you have an instinct to kind of hold back and be a little protective, self-protective. And I found that I was harshest and funniest when I was criticizing myself from somebody else's point of view. And so that's why I have a story from the perspective of a hamster whose wife I murdered by mistake and stories like that, because it allowed me to be harsher and hopefully funnier.
So that's interesting. Does that happen in the kind of technical part when you've had a germ of an idea and you're thinking about how to structure the story? Or is it more like you're just sitting around in your house thinking about what you were like when you were 8 and it suddenly occurs to you that maybe you were actually not a nice person?
My basic trick that I've been using in my fiction for years is just to take a pretty basic situation and then try to examine it from an unusual point of view. So, like, for example, in my last book, The Last Girlfriend on Earth, I have a story about a teenage boy trying to lose his virginity, which is a very cliched sort of story. There are a few R-rated Hollywood movies about that subject every summer, it feels like. But I wanted to tell that story because it's a personal story and it's hopefully relatable to people. And I decided to tell it from the point of view of an unused condom living inside of the teenage boy's wallet, who is waiting and waiting and waiting for years and years and years in the hopes of being used. And so that's an example of me trying to sort of tell an old story, but hopefully in a new way.
So I'm curious about your comedic influences. Are there particular writers that you read growing up who've really influenced your work, writers you love?
Yeah, I grew up reading the usual suspects in terms of funny writers. I read a lot of Woodhouse and Waugh and Douglas Adams and Joe Heller and so on. But I also read a lot of, I would call it like high-stakes, premise-driven fiction, whether it was funny or not. So I also loved Kurt Vonnegut. I loved Stephen King and T.C. Boyle. And I was obsessed with Shirley Jackson. I love The Simpsons, you know, but I love The Twilight Zone just as much. Anything that had a big hook about 40 seconds into it, I was psyched about.
So speaking of great premises, we should talk about the standout story in the book, Sellout. And this is the one that was originally serialized on the New Yorker's website. Can you kind of give us a synopsis, describe the premise?
Yeah. So Sellout is about my great-great-grandfather, Herschel Rich, who was a hardscrabble immigrant from the old country who came to New York City with pennies in his pocket. And in the story, he is working at his hellish job in a pickle factory. And one day, 15 hours into a shift, he falls into a vat of pickle brine and he gets brined for 100 years. And he emerges in present-day Brooklyn, unaged. And the scientists introduce him to his great-great-grandson, who is me, Simon Rich. And we become roommates. And he does not like me. And it's about our sort of struggle to get along. And the thing he doesn't like about me is how much stuff I take for granted, because I'm always complaining about spotty internet access, or, you know, when the computer is slow. And meanwhile, he's watched much of his family die, you know, of cholera and various other ailments. So it's a story about how sometimes I lose perspective and take things for granted. And I wanted to write a story like that to kind of jolt myself back into self-awareness.
Could I get you to read us an excerpt from it to get a sense of Herschel's voice? His voice is just so distinctive.
Yeah, so in the story, Herschel and his great-great-grandson, Simon Rich, they get into a fight, and Herschel storms out of the brownstone where Simon Rich lives, and he decides to strike out on his own. He has no money, and he has no food, but that's how he came to this country, so he's undaunted, and he bravely sets out on his own. But things go poorly, and he's almost starving to death when we get to this scene, which takes place by a Whole Foods dumpster. I look and see a gang of bearded hobos. They are scavenging through trash bin, picking out packages of food. Check the sell-by date, one says. I bet these things aren't even stale. It is amazing, I think, that these bums have so happy a spirit. I decide it is safe to introduce myself. I step out of the shadows and hold up my palms in show of peace. I am Herschel, I say, from village of Slupsk. Cool, one of them says, an international student. Another one squints at my wool and pokes his fingers at the buttons. Where'd you get this, he asks. From a thrift store? I make it from old rags, I admit. For some reason, this pathetic fact impresses them. That's rad, they say. Talk about DIY. I am very hungry, I say. You came to the right place, says the man with the longest beard. We've been dumpster diving all semester, and this place is by far the sickest. I do not want to become sick, but my hunger is extreme. I say a quick prayer and then dive inside the trash bin.
Simon Rich is the author of the short story collection, Spoiled Brats.
Hi, welcome to the law offices of Saul Goodman and Associates. From parking tickets to mass murder, from slip and fall to bond fraud, Saul Goodman and Associates is your one-stop shop for all your legal needs. So if they say you're Breaking Bad, you better call Saul.
That's Bob Odenkirk. You might know him as the criminal lawyer, Saul Goodman, from the TV shows Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. He's been doing a lot of acting lately, but he actually has a long career as a comedy writer. He wrote for Saturday Night Live. He co-created the sketch comedy TV series Mr. Show with Bob and David. And last year, he released his first book, A Load of Hooey. That's the title, not a description. Doug Gordon sat down to talk with him.
Bob, I wonder if there was something more satisfying and pure about writing for print because of the fact you don't have to worry about convincing the suits, the network executives, to give you a few million dollars to hire actors and crew. Instead, you have this total creative freedom.
Yeah, well, not only that. Listen, Doug, I totally indulged myself in this book. I would like to point out to you that the last people I thank are the directors and members of the Lilly Guild, New York Local 214. Do you know what Lilly Gilding means?
Yes, I do.
Gilding the Lily. I mean, I overwrote stuff in here.
Do you think?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I edited it, but I did not hesitate to make myself laugh and put things in that I would not leave in a presentation kind of way. Like, if I perform stuff, I tend to perform these pieces shorter than they're written.
Mm-hmm.
I cut stuff out. I did that on purpose. I said, this book is going to be a place for me to kind of just go past my lengths of silliness and just dig in deeper on more silliness than I would normally leave in. Because I figure it's a book that you pick up and read one piece at a time, and then you put it down, and then you pick it up 2 days later and read two pieces, and then you put it down, and then 3 years from now you pick it up and you just enjoy the journey of the little pieces one at a time.
What do you think good comedy is about?
My daughter asked me what comedy was. She asked me two things when she was like 7 or 8. She said, Dad, tell me about comedy. What is it? And I said, well, comedy is about being honest. It can be a brutal honesty, but it's some way of telling a truth about people. In A Load of Hooey, I wrote a piece called Martin Luther King Jr.'s Worst Speech Ever. And it's just an imagining of Martin Luther King stumbling and talking to himself and feeling inadequate, which he probably never did, but maybe once, right? One of his speeches was the worst one he ever gave.
Had to be.
Right?
For sure.
Okay. So it wasn't as bad as the one I wrote for him.
That's for sure.
Hello. Hi. I was not told I would be speaking today, but I guess I'm Martin Luther King, so I'm invited to a church. I should have put two and two together. Okay, you can do this, King. Come on, let's get it together. All right. We stand together today, all of us, black and white. Well, there's not so many white people here. Maybe some in the back, but not important. Moving on. All of us today are a great conflagration. What? That's not a word. Congregation. Same thing. Whew, it's hot in here. Man, it is hot in this great state of Kentucky. What? What's that? Alabama? Mississippi. Okay, Mississippi. Then why did I gotta say Alabama?
You know, there's something in taking icons and reminding ourselves that they're people. It almost makes them more valuable because they did something amazing with just the same tools that you or I have.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that comedy, except for prop comedy, I don't know what prop comedy is about, but I think that other kinds of comedy are generally, it's generally about being honest. The other thing my daughter asked me was, what's the most fun you ever had doing your job? And the answer was so quick and simple. I was lucky enough to write a scene for Second City called The Motivational Speaker that Chris Farley did. And to be clear, it was based on a voice Chris did, you know, already. I'd seen him do in an improv set, but I just gave it a story and structure. But I got to do that sketch 8 times a week on the Second City stage with Chris doing Matt Foley 2 feet from my face. And that was just the purest joy I've ever experienced. Over and over and over every single time. It was crazy.
And of course, that has that famous line that lives on that I'll let you say it because I'll butcher it. Plus, it'll sound better coming out of your mouth than mine.
Living in a van down by the river.
Right? Exactly. Yeah, that's it. That's a classic. One of many great pieces in A Load of Hooey is called Her Laughter. I'm wondering, could I get you to read the first page, please?
Let's read something else. Let's read The Phil Spector I Knew. Is that okay?
Sure. I have the audiobook anyway, so I can always pull a piece of whatever
I
want.
You know what? If you have the audiobook, would you do me a favor and play one of my favorite things that we ever recorded, which was Brian Posehn reading I Found a Jackson Pollock Today?
Okay.
Let's play that right here. This is my friend Brian Posehn reading a poem I wrote, I Found a Jackson Pollock.
Excuse me for jumping and shouting hooray, but I found a Jackson Pollock today. It was under the stairs, behind some chairs. It had been there for years, we were all unawares. In a spare space of clutter, with old brooms and dustbins, in rurally rural old rural Wisconsin. At first I'd no idea, unsure what I'd found. Some old thing worth nothing, thought I. Nothing world-renowned. But now I know it's a Pollock, and here's how I know. All the splotches of paint are placed there just so. They pop and they mingle to coax forth a mood. They tell you a story, they force you to brood. Upon their deep meaning, there's just something more there than just splotches of paint that are going nowhere. So I know it's a real one, a top-notch big deal one. The kind that will hang in a Met or a Getty. And when I know what it's worth, will I sell it? You betty.
Oh, Brian is so funny.
Definitely. That is vintage Posehn. And you gave him great material to work with. I especially love the Getty Betty rhyme. While I was reading A Load of Hooey, I thought about Picasso's famous quote, every act of creation is first of all an act of destruction. And that seems especially true of comedy and the kind of satire that you like to create. What do you think?
Yeah, no, I think you're right. I've thought about that a lot lately. It makes me feel a little bad, to be honest with you, because destruction is easier than construction, and it's easier to tear things down than it is to build them up.
But there are a lot of things that need to be torn down, that need to be destroyed, don't you think?
And it helps. It helps to tear it down. It can encourage you to build it up more properly, or it can encourage you to continue trying to fix things when you see their faults. There's ultimately maybe a constructive value to it, but in the end, it is easier to destroy stuff.
Funnier, too.
And funnier. It's a lot more fun, yeah. Come on.
Do you have favorite things you like to destroy in your work?
I have a strange relationship with religion. I really do. I mean, I would never call myself an atheist, and I don't know where to sign up for it either. But I can't be called a true believer for sure. So I don't know where I lie on that scale. I can't figure it out myself.
Agnostic, maybe?
Yeah, I don't know. Agnostic is so... It feels like you're being, like, committedly non-committal. You got to ask me this question literally a minute before I die, and then I'll tell you what I believe.
Okay.
Until then, it's all up in the air. An angel of the Lord came unto me. I thought that was cool. Worth mentioning, anyways. It told me that I could ask any question I had and I'd get the truth. So I asked, which religion is right and true? He thought for a moment and said, I cannot specify by name, but two religions are true. Two? I said, how can that be? He shrugged and said, what can I say? That's the way it is. I said, can you possibly help me narrow it down? He nodded and said, okay, I shouldn't do this, but... I can tell you that Scientology is not one of the true ones. Does that help you? No, I said. No, that does not help.
Is acting as satisfying as writing and performing your own work? Because, correct me if I'm wrong, but you consider yourself a writer first, don't you? Or has that changed now? Do you still consider yourself a writer first and foremost?
I don't know. I've been doing so much performing and acting, and also more than just sort of quantity. It's been really challenging, and I've had to think about it and make an effort and break it down and discover what I can do and push myself further. So I guess I'm becoming more of an actor in how I perceive myself. You know, we'll see where it goes.
Mm-hmm.
That's writer, performer, and actor Bob Odenkirk talking with Doug Gordon. Bob will be teaming up with longtime collaborator David Cross later this month on a new Netflix series called With Bob and David. Coming up, Bachelors of Science, Marie Curie versus Marie Claire, and how to build a biological clock out of a potato. Comedy writer Megan Amram gives us science for her. And we'll talk with Bob Mankoff, the cartoon editor of The New Yorker. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Some of the best comedy can make you laugh and feel uncomfortable all at the same time. Comedy writer Megan Amram manages to both amuse and horrify in her new book, Science for Her. It's a girl-friendly guide to science. Imagine science as taught by a Glamour magazine editor. Megan got her start writing jokes on Twitter. Now she's a writer for the popular sitcom Parks and Recreation, but this new book is a bit edgier.
Reasons scientifically why women can't drive. Speed. Speed is how much distance is covered over a certain amount of time. Women can't control the speed of their cars because speed is measured in numbers, which are a major aspect of mathematics, something that is immediately erased from your memory when you listen to Katy Perry. Velocity. Velocity is speed over time. It measures a rate of change of speed. Women can't control the velocity of their cars because their pocket mirrors, gems, or Greek yogurt fall into the accelerator pedal, making the car speed up infinitely until the car explodes or they reach the mall. Displacement. Displacement is the distance between an object's initial position and its final position. Women can't understand the displacement of their cars because it's measured in feet, and feet reminds us of shoes, a Louboutin, and then we forget how many feet we're supposed to be thinking of. Spatial reasoning. In general, women have no idea where their bodies or cars are in space. Right before I wrote this, I ran into a clean window just like a bird. I guess that's on me for cleaning my windows so gosh darn well every Sunday.
Megan, how would you characterize the voice of Science for Her?
The voice of Science for Her is a cosmopolitan writer on a bunch of drugs who has just been pushed to the nth degree. She is in love with the reader. She calls all the readers her best friends, but also says that they're too fat to turn the pages. She's very passive-aggressive. It's really a roller coaster.
And sort of reads like a science textbook that's been edited by, you know, the editors of Cosmo, kind of like what if Cosmo covered the cosmos?
Yes, I think that's a good way of putting it. The whole premise is that women's brains are too small to understand real male science textbooks that we all got in middle and high school. So I have written a girly one that makes it look very fun and flirty. There's a lot of pink and there's a lot of pictures of clothing and me looking very thin in it, just to put it on a girl's level for our tiny little cute brains.
So for you to go to all the work of writing all of this, there had to be some big driving kind of passion. Do you just really loathe those women's magazines?
I just blacked out for 3 months and woke up and this book was here. I will say, if you read the book, the narrator of Megan Amram is obviously very, very obsessed with her ex-boyfriend Xander, which is the driving force for her within the book to have written it. She became a scientist because he broke up with her after she admitted that she didn't know any science and had lied on her resume and had actually gotten a job at NASA. It's all very complicated. But the real me, who wrote this book, wanted to gently poke fun at something that I thought was a fairly sexist institution. But more than that, I wanted to make fun of sexism in general, both from within media like magazines or TV, and also from people in the public eye just saying things that I disagreed with. So I would call this a feminist satirical science textbook, which, you know, there's a lot of them, but I hope mine rises to the top.
The other thing that I think really makes this work so well is the tone that you've captured. We know so well, at least those of us who are women and who have ever read any of those magazines. It's this kind of, well, I've read you describe it as a fake feminist tone.
I think that was one of the things I was most obsessed with. When I first started writing the book, I bought like 30 women's magazines and read them all at once so I could get into some sort of trance and really take in how the editorial voice was used in all these magazines over the course of many months. And that was what I took away from it the most, was that it seemed passive aggressive to me and that it was cheering on women. That's what the, I guess, fake feminist might be, is like, you look great, girl. You're gonna get this job. You don't need that boy. You're so over him, girlfriend. But then is inherently telling you what you should do to be better or look better or feel better. And there was a little bit of a discrepancy there for me of, you're saying that we're all fine, but then also that we have to do all these things to be perfect.
Is there a section that you could read to illustrate that? The one that just popped into my mind is there's a section on weight laws instead of weight loss.
Yeah. Weight laws tips. Get it? Instead of weight loss tips. Mass is different from weight, but both of them are bad. Mass is the actual amount of stuff something is made of, and weight is how much that mass weighs in certain gravitational field. So, like, if you weigh 120 pounds on Earth, and I do, JK, I weigh way less, that doesn't mean you'd weigh that much in a different gravitational field. In fact, Earth is one of the worst places to be if you're a 120-pound heifer. Best gravitational fields for losing weight. If you weigh 120 pounds on Earth, here's what you weigh on other planets. Saturn, 127.6 pounds. It will be like you spent the week binging on Cheerios. Ugh. You will be so bloated and gross. Ugh. No one wants that. Venus, 108.8 pounds. Now that's what I'm talking about. Mars, 37.7 pounds. You look so good. Oh my God. You weigh approximately the same as a sexy bowling ball. Mercury, 38.7 pounds. Ugo, you look super bloated compared to Mars. You're going to try to convince yourself it's water weight. It's not.
Megan Amram is the author of Science for Her. Every week, at the back of the New Yorker magazine, the editors publish a cartoon, and they challenge readers to come up with a caption, which is a lot harder than it looks. There is an art to writing a successful New Yorker cartoon. For instance, the legendary cartoonist Bob Mankoff tried 500 times for more than 2 years before he got one published. Today, he's the cartoon editor of the New Yorker, so I guess he can get his revenge by rejecting other writers. He's also the author of a new memoir, How About Never? Is Never Good for You? My Life in Cartoons. Steve Paulson sat down with him.
Bob, is there a special magic sauce for a good New Yorker cartoon?
I think the recipe requires many sauces, aged over time. There's not one thing that is a New Yorker cartoon. I think it's many things. I think it's whimsy, it's intelligence, it's absurdity, it's topicality, it's really all of those things. And I think the main thing is that it makes you think about not only issues, but about yourself as well. So let's say there's a New Yorker cartoon, which there is, a Roz Chass cartoon where it's a guy looking at the obituary. And on the obituary, it says, 2 years older than you, 3 years younger than you, your age right on the dot. So I think cartoons like that are just a window into the human condition. Another cartoon, it's called French Army Knife, and it's like a Swiss Army Knife, except they're all corkscrews. So in each one, you understand something. And, of course, the cartoon in my book, which is the title of my book, The guy's looking at his appointment book and on the phone, and he's saying, no, Thursday's out. How about never is never good for you? So that's the cartoon that people reprint a lot, license a lot, and put my daughter through college.
Oh, well, there you go. I'm struck by something you said, that these are cartoons that make you think, not necessarily cartoons that make you laugh.
You laughed.
I did, yes.
I know. It's not... only politeness. I understand that, but I do appreciate it.
It's not just politeness.
Usually, it's a smile of the mind. I think people do laugh at them, but, you know, laughter is a very social phenomenon. For the most part, people don't laugh when they're alone. And for the most part, you're reading The New Yorker when you're alone. But I do think the cartoons are genuinely also funny. But there's always something, there is something to get. I'm going to describe a cartoon to you where it's Einstein, Albert Einstein, of all people, is in bed with a young woman. And Einstein is saying to the young woman, they both don't have any clothes on, to you it was fast. So, look, you just proved me wrong. You said people don't laugh. I mean, unless you just are the most extraordinarily polite radio host, there it is, proof of concept. But I do think there's more of a cognitive element. The thing that people really laugh most at is other people falling down to music, funny music. That's what America's Funniest Home Videos are. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to get. Nobody says to you, I don't get it. The guy got hit in the crotch with a ball, but he's okay. I got it.
Yeah. So basically, the New Yorker cartoon, obviously, you have to have some humor there, but there's an idea at work.
There's always an idea. And often when I give a talk, I show the contract I got to become a New Yorker cartoonist. And nowhere in the contract does it mention the word cartoon. It calls them idea drawings. So I think, you know, in a way, that's pretty significant.
So have the standards for what makes it as a New Yorker cartoon, have they changed over the years? I mean, you know, people have been making New Yorker cartoons for decades now.
Back to 1925, I think humor changes. I don't think the standards change in that an awful lot are submitted and very few are chosen. That's just sort of the nature of the publishing business, really, in the New Yorker magazine. 1,000 cartoons might come in a week.
1,000 in a week?
Yeah, and I will take 50 or 60 to the meeting with David Remnick.
The editor of The New Yorker.
The editor of The New Yorker, and out of those, 17 will be picked. And I've told David, I said, you know, we could get a lot more cartoons in the magazine if we just eliminated the articles. And he doesn't go for that for some reason. So I think it's always very, very competitive.
So 1,000 come into your offices every week. And how many of those do you actually look at?
Well, I definitely look at the 500 from our regular contributors. My assistant will look at the people mail in stuff. And I actually don't look at all of those, but I do instruct him because my assistant, Colin Stokes, has been with me a while, and he knows what I'm looking for, that anything that looks interesting, because every year new cartoonists come into the New Yorker magazine, so we do look at all of it.
So you boil it down to, what did you say, 30, something like that?
Well, I'll take about 50 or 60 to the meeting with David Remnick, and from those we'll choose, and David will make the final choice for these 17.
Now, why David? I mean, yes, I know he's the editor of the magazine, but he's a news guy, isn't he? I mean,
well, he's got a good sense of humor, and that's the way it's always been. Remember, the cartoons are not occurring in an isolated comedy environment. They're occurring within the context of the New Yorker magazine. That's his bailiwick. That's his purview. That's his home. He's the thing that's creating it. Mm-hmm. And essentially, he's hanging those pictures on the wall. And so I do think his input is very important because he, I think, has an overall sense of what the magazine will bear in terms of edginess or potential offense.
And the New Yorker cartoons tend not to be too edgy. They're not ones that are so much in your face where they're likely to offend you.
And yet people are offended. They are offended, you know, so if we run, you know, a cartoon where there's a woman saying to another woman, I've only been gluten-free for a week and I'm already really annoying. Okay, so we'll get letters from people who are on gluten-free diets, who have celiac disease, and we'll say how serious that disease is and shame on us for producing that cartoon. I don't think they take the point that it's obviously not for people who have celiac disease. It's for all the other people who are on gluten-free diets and are really annoying.
So coming back to this question of how tastes have changed at The New Yorker, can you give me an example of a cartoon that, I don't know, might have been popular 30 years ago, 50 years ago that just wouldn't make it today just because, I don't know, our standards of humor have changed or your editorial style has changed?
The cartoons, I think, used to be, I guess, fairly mild, just sort of buzzword jokes. You know, it might be something, I think, his wife saying to another woman, I think he hates Nixon first, Agnew next, and then me. You know, it'd be very much just sort of related to that type of thing. I mean, to some extent, The New Yorker still takes away a lot of the natural levers of aggression, transgression, obscenity that you will find in a comedy club. When you're in The New Yorker, you're in an environment where, oh, here's this whole article about Ebola and another one about ISIS. When you're in a serious mood like that, it's easy for you to feel that a joke is inappropriate or diminishes the seriousness of the enterprise in general. So for the most part, our jokes are really about ourselves rather than others, where most of humor is what I call dispositional. It basically, it works like, you know, to summarize, I'm okay, you're a jerk. You know, whether it's O'Reilly
or
Johnson, I'm okay, you're a jerk. But I think The New Yorker humor, I would say the premise is we're both okay and we're both jerks. I mean, that's what the joke really is. We tweak our own liberal sensibilities. So let's say I did a cartoon in which one woman is saying to another at a bar, I hate to admit it, but a man with a big carbon footprint makes me hot. Okay, so that tweaks our liberal sensibilities, as does a joke in which one caveman is saying to the other, I don't understand it. The air is pure. The water is clean. Everything we eat is organic, but nobody lives past 30. So that also is sort of tweaking liberal sensibilities, as does a cartoon in which an auto salesman is saying, it runs on conventional gasoline until it senses guilt, and then it switches to electric. So all of those are really about us and our sensibilities, which is really the stock and trade of most humor and satire, which is the satirization of the other political party, the other sect, the other whatever.
Bob Mankoff is the cartoon editor for The New Yorker and author of How About Never? Is Never Good for You? My Life in Cartoons. He talked with Steve Paulson. Coming up, The Secret Life of Passwords is on our minds, and a dangerous idea. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge, from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. And now it's time for A Dangerous Idea.
My name is Scott Westerfeld, and I'm a writer of novels for teens, including the Uglies and Leviathan series and my latest book, Afterworlds. My dangerous idea is that we'll all wind up teenagers. Let me start with the fact that teenagers are relatively new. Prior to about a century ago, there were only two stages of life, infant and adult. People went straight from being a child to being a factory worker, a miner, a soldier, or perhaps were married off. For the first few thousand years of human civilization, there was no intermediate stage, no adolescence to speak of. But starting in the 19th century, child labor laws began to appear, and many of the great powers stopped using child soldiers and sailors. And in some places, marriageable ages were raised to the mid-teens. In this gap between child and adult, a new phase of life began to form. In 1928, the word teenage appears in English, followed by teenager in 1941. Like anything new, of course, teenagers were first greeted with terror and calumny. In movies as classic as Rebel Without a Cause and Reefer Madness, they are portrayed as rudderless, uncivilized, and dangerous. The first great contribution of teen taste to American culture, rock and roll, was reviled as the devil's music, and every subsequent teen mania has been greeted with media outrage. From Elvis to rap stars, skateboard to scooters, blue jeans to hoodies, file sharing to sexting to MySpace to Snapchat, teenage obsessions are always the subject of adult moral panics. And yet, teen culture prevails. For the last decade, novels as diverse as Harry Potter, Twilight, The Hunger Games, and The Fault in Our Stars have drawn millions of adults as readers. But like rock and roll, they started with a teen or younger audience and have attracted the same censure from the media. Too sexy, too dark, too violent, too sad. In a word, too teenage. And yet, like rock and roll, they're here to stay. Lately, the growing dominance of teen culture has prompted some critics to wonder if adulthood itself might be coming to an end. But is this such a bad thing? Adolescence is a time of experimentation, of idealism, of language and skills acquisition, and of reflexively doubting authority. In the old world, these processes were only valuable until one acquired membership in one's chosen guild. Thereafter, they might destabilize the position one had achieved. But in contemporary life, innovation is perpetually necessary. As a result, what we now call being a teenager, this rebellious, unruly, uncertain, playful, and idealistic new stage of life, is expanding upward into the 20s and beyond. And eventually, perhaps, all but the very young and very ossified will be, for lack of a better word, teenagers.
Writer Scott Westerfeld with his dangerous idea. You can find more of them on our website at ttbook.org. Computer passwords are on our minds this week. We all know we're supposed to have different passwords for everything. And not just different, but strong passwords. You know, those lists of random letters and numbers. But it turns out, most of us just can't resist personalizing our passwords. Even at the risk of our own cybersecurity, we compose passwords that are full of personal meaning. New York Times reporter Ian Urbina has uncovered the secret life of passwords, and he wrote a piece about it for the New York Times Magazine.
When she first got sick, I really just wanted to get everything I could from her. I knew I had some time, but not forever. I wanted to learn more about our family and her favorite things and have these stories that I could tell my children about her. Using my passwords as even just a way to remind me of our family homestead or these great vacation memories. But it also got really hard. Her illness consumed my life. When I was at work, I started to use that as an escape to not think about our family and what we were going through, you know, to have these inane passwords that were sort of not thought-provoking at all. And then at the end, right after she passed away, my password was Prospect. I moved to Prospect Heights, started this new life that she always wanted me to have. That's what I needed to start my day and have that little reminder that it was going to be okay.
The sort of the anti-password password. They do everything that they're not supposed to. They're not disposable, like good, secure passwords are supposed to be, and they're not meaningless. They're sort of rich in emotion. And they seem to be more pervasive than I had ever imagined, because virtually everyone I talked to had a similar sort of keepsake password.
I love that phrase. You came up with keepsake password. What's behind that word?
We struggled with what to call it. We thought maybe locket password or diary password, and keepsake sort of stuck. I think what we liked about it was it had two resonances. One was that in keeping it, you sort of harbored it for time. And secondly, it had almost a tchotchke type element in that in and of itself, it was meaningless, but you imbue it with meaning because it's got this special personal story to it. So keepsake seemed like the right term.
And both tchotchkes and keepsakes are little things that seem insignificant, but are like keys that can unlock whole stories or memories.
Yeah, and that was one of the things I sort of marveled at throughout the reporting was in 8-character code, you could hear a half an hour to an hour worth of emotion and story and history and layers of the onion if you got someone talking, because there was a lot packed into them.
For example, what's one of the first ones you heard that just kind of knocked you out?
One of the first ones I heard was actually a really sad one. I was at a park watching my son on the jungle gym, and I struck up a conversation with a stranger. And she told me that several years prior, her son had committed suicide. and that when she was sort of rifling through his desk later on, she came across a piece of paper that had Lambda 69 written on it, and it looked like it was his password. And she didn't know what that meant, and she started looking on the internet and realized that Lambda was this kind of common symbol in gay history and stood for liberation and other things. And 69 was a number, but it also was the year of the 1969 Stonewall riots, sort of a famous moment in gay history. And this woman started piecing together her reflections of her son, and soon it dawned on her that her son had been gay. And she had not known that up until that moment when she started exploring sort of what his password might have meant.
Wow. So that's a story of password as secret.
Yeah, and as portal. That was the funny thing. These passwords, even when I talk with family that I've known all my life, this topic had this strange, almost time machine-esque quality to it where it leapfrogged you into a space that normally you don't get to access, and sometimes even introduce you to things you didn't know about people you had known for much of your life.
Did that happen to you when you talked with family or friends?
It did, actually, with my wife and with my son. My wife and I were talking about it very early on about the topic, and we started talking about her passwords, and she had these digits that she often used in her password, and I'd never thought to ask her what they were, and it turns out those digits were the street address for her father's first sort of boyhood home. And she kept those digits in her password because her father, who was this really stellar athlete when he was growing up and in college, a huge guy, 280, 270, and he had a really severe stutter growing up. When he was young, to say his home address, he had to sing it. The four digits that my wife had in her password were the first four digits of his home address. And for her, it sort of recalled both her father's strength and his weakness all in one. And I just thought that was marvelous. And I had never heard that story.
My God, that's like a password as a tiny little short story.
Yeah, that's just it. That's perfectly put. So many of them were like that. They had these really rich stories.
Now, I would think this would be a difficult subject to research because most people wouldn't want to tell you their passwords. They're supposed to be secret. But people seem to have been surprisingly open with you.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to chalk that up to my skills as an investigative reporter, but
that must be it.
It's quite not. The real mystery here is why people were so willing to tell me, even eager to tell the stories. And
well, plus the stories they told you, these must be some of their favorite passwords, and passwords they've used for years, and presumably once they tell them to you, aren't those passwords burned?
Yeah, I mean, that's the sort of inherently destructive element of talking about people's secrets. It's really enjoyable while you do it, but then it's no longer a secret. I have a theory as to why people were willing, eager even to tell me, and I don't know if it's right, but my theory is just that we all suffer from a certain burden and pent-up frustration with kind of the tidal wave of information we have to swim through every day and things we have to remember, all the data, and also just sort of the nervousness and stress of security concerns on the internet, privacy. And I think all that sort of funnels down into pent-up anxiety that I felt like when I presented this topic to people, even strangers, it offered them a doorway to catharsis, you know, sort of this opportunity to just sort of irrationally thumb their nose at all that pressure and just tell something they're not supposed to tell. I don't know if that's right, but that felt like it was the best explanation to why people were willing to tell me so often.
Okay, well, this is the point where we have to say, in case there's somebody listening who has a password story they want to share with you, where do they send them?
Just to my email, and that's just my last name. So it's URB as in boy, I, N as in Nancy, A, and then the at symbol, nytimes.com, newyorktimes.com.
When I was 12 years old, I had an instant messenger. That is the first thing that I remember wanting to protect because I did not want my mother reading my conversations that I was having because I was cussing. My password was Travolta. It came from a song by a band called Mr. Bungle. And there's this moment in this weird kind of circus medley song where the lead singer, Mike Patton, just whispers, "Travolta." It's very dark and ominous. My mother did her best to encourage me to be my own person, even if that person was different than she wanted me to be. But I found out later that my mom had a keyboard tracker. She knew all of my passwords and was able to read every single one of my conversations I had had ever on that computer. She's still very sneaky. Now, as an adult, when I really don't have anything to hide from her, I feel like she very easily could still have access to all of my passwords. The thought is kind of charming that my mother really will always know the deepest, darkest parts of me. Not because I tell her, but because she has all my passwords.
Ian Urbina is a reporter for the New York Times and the author of the Times Magazine's feature story, The Secret Life of Passwords. And thanks to the New York Times for some of the audio. That's it for this hour, but there's more online. If you like what you heard today, why not subscribe to our podcast? Just look us up on iTunes or Stitcher or any other podcasting app. And if you really want to help us out, leave a review. That helps other people find the show. This hour was produced by Doug Gordon. The rest of the team includes Raymond Tungekar, Craig Ely, and Charles Monroe Kane. Special thanks to engineers Joe Hartke and Brittany Williams. Music by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Audio wizardry courtesy of our technical director, Kirill Owen. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson, and I'm Anne Strainchamps. Till next time.
PRI, Public Radio International.